Hey folks, Preet here. Big Supreme Court news this week. The justices unanimously ruled that states cannot disqualify former President Donald Trump from the ballot for his role in the January 6th insurrection and seeking to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. But the justices were divided on how far the decision should go. Meanwhile, the court granted review of Trump's immunity defense in the election subversion criminal prosecution. Oral arguments are scheduled for late April, complicating Trump's trial calendar, as Judge Cannon in Florida also considers when to schedule the Mar-a-Lago documents trial. Joyce Vance and I discuss all that and more on the Cafe Insider podcast. To hear our full conversation and access all other Cafe Insider content, try the membership for just $1 for 1 month. You can do that at cafe.com/insider. That's cafe.com/insider. We look forward to having you as a part of the Insider community. So let's talk about the first item, which we've been talking about for some time, and it's a bit of a controversial subject, and people have different views about how it should have gone, but the Supreme Court ruled in fairly short order, 9-0, on the question of whether or not Donald Trump, by operation of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, could be removed from the ballot based on the language of that section of the 14th Amendment that relates to insurrection. And I will say, I don't want to do any sort of I told you so's. Of course, when people preface a sentence with, I don't want to do any I told you so's, what follows is often some kind of I told you so.
Go for it.
But any surprise here other than it's 9-0?
No surprises. And I think that there was plenty of suggestion, not just from oral argument, but before, that this argument was not going to succeed. Can I start, though, by telling you the one thing that I dislike about the court's opinion beyond the holding is, and maybe this is unfair, but I detect a little bit of a tone of fear of Trump, of fear of the consequences of telling Trump no. And that concerns me a little bit coming from the court.
Where do you find that? What is the language that suggests that to you?
So, you know, there's some snark that goes on in the concurrence from the three progressive judges, where they repeatedly refer to Trump as an oath-breaking insurrectionist. And the per curiam opinion does not, by the way, take on the conclusion of the Colorado trial court that Trump engaged in insurrection. That's not the basis for this opinion. But there is this overtone of, you know, bad things that would happen if you remove a candidate from the ballot. And Justice Barrett, in her concurrence, her lone concurrence, talks about the need to take the temperature down. While that might be a really great goal in our society right now, you know, this is a court that spends a lot of time talking about literal adherence to the text of the law. And yet here they are talking about concern about what's going on in society, not just their legal doctrinal obligations. And I just have that sense that there's a fear of Trump that pervades the result in this case.
Essentially, the question that was before the court was, quote, did the Colorado Supreme Court err, depending on your preference, in ordering President Trump excluded from the 2024 presidential primary ballot? And then, in partial answer to the question, the court writes, quote, this case raises the question whether the states, in addition to Congress, may also enforce Section 3. We conclude that states may disqualify persons holding or attempting to hold state office, but states have no power under the Constitution to enforce Section 3 with respect to federal offices, especially the presidency, end quote. So they say, if you have engaged in insurrection or given comfort and aid to insurrectionists by the language of Section 3 of our, by the language of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, states can and have, and there's a tradition of this, can and have disqualified people for running for state office, but for various reasons, including the supremacy of federal law and the need for uniformity across the union when it comes to who can and cannot be on the ballot, they have no business excluding a presidential candidate from the ballot. And I will say, as I've said all along, and I understand the arguments that were made, and I understand they were plausible arguments, I don't think they were necessarily frivolous arguments, but I have always thought that that argument was not on the winning side. Notwithstanding some very smart people who said again and again and again, I think overly aggressively, that it was a no-brainer that he should be removed from the ballot. Do you have a view on that?
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. There's an elegant little argument in the per curiam opinion where the justices say no one contends that a state could remove a federal office holder from office. And they then reason from that point going forward that there's no reason a state can disqualify someone running for federal office. And the point that they make is that no one really contends that point, that this is just beyond the state's authority. And I think, you know, the argument is dead right there, as we say.
Yeah, this distinction between whether that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment can work that magic after someone is in office versus before someone is in office exposes one of the flaws of the argument. What do you make of the uniformity argument? I mean, essentially, one of the arguments bought by all the justices, I think all the justices, is that you have one state that would decide to remove a presidential candidate from the ballot for, you know, some reason, another state deciding for a different reason, another state deciding to keep the person on the ballot for yet another reason. Meanwhile, the nucleus of facts, you know, relating to the alleged insurrection is the same in all of those states. And so, and you also have different evidentiary standards from state to state. You have different, you know, legal mechanisms for that happening. It's different in Colorado from the way it was done in Maine. And that kind of inconsistency on the part of, you know, the 50 states with respect to a presidential election in particular, and they make a big point of saying the state shouldn't be able to remove federal candidates from the ballot, and all the problems associated with that and the worries associated with that are magnified when you're talking about the person who would become the commander in chief. Those are not crazy arguments. And by the way, as I mentioned before, the three progressives joined in those arguments.
You know, they're not crazy arguments, but they're the kind of arguments that you would expect to hear progressives make, and not the conservative members of the court, because really what these come down to, I mean, there's a little bit of a contrarianism going on here. We don't have one national, one federal election. We've got 50 state elections. That's how the Constitution sets these things up, relegating a lot of the authority over time, place, manner of these elections to the states. And so there is a little note of irony when you have conservative justices signing off on this viewpoint. I agree that it makes sense. I mean, there's something unwieldy and impractical about letting individual states make these decisions. And yet, if you look at the way the system is envisioned, it's tough to say that maybe the founding fathers, and in this case, when we're talking about the 14th Amendment, really we're talking about post-Civil War drafters, might not have seen this a little bit differently than some of today's conservatives do.
Yeah, look, and the court makes the point also that the adoption of the 14th Amendment was very explicitly designed to shift a certain amount of power from the states to the federal government. And in that context, the argument makes even more sense. Right.
Well, that's right. And they do trace that history of the shift. And they talk very explicitly about the notion that the federal government is being given some restorative authority. So that does make the argument still stronger.
It also, I think, shows up the weakness of the argument that having engaged in an insurrection, whatever that means, is a self-executing automatic bar to running for federal office in the same way that the age requirement of 35 for the presidency or 30 for the Senate is an absolute bar, because the latter category is much more objectively defined than insurrection and the engagement in insurrection. And, you know, people don't like that argument. People love to make the argument that it's the same thing. It's not, for, you know, definitionally, and there's a subjective aspect to it. And you may believe, and I believe, that Donald Trump supported and engaged in an insurrection and cited an insurrection. That doesn't mean it's an easy thing to be decided and to be decided differently between and among the 50 different states. And it's also different because, unlike the age requirement, as we've discussed before, the 14th Amendment lays out a remedy and a fix for that, because a two-thirds majority of the Congress can take away that disability. And that's completely different.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And from the point where you started, you know, the Supreme Court either agrees that Trump is an oath-breaking insurrectionist, or at a minimum, the per curiam justices do not dispute that fact, right? I mean, this is not an opinion that's about whether or not Donald Trump engaged in insurrection. It's just about the mechanism for excluding him from running. And so I think that the argument you make is the correct one. There's something, there's almost a sense, you know, I always thought there was a due process argument lurking here that never quite materialized, saying that you couldn't remove somebody from the ballot without some sort of a formal decision about their status. I think what's interesting here, and a point that gets made throughout the concurrences, is that according to this decision, only Congress is empowered with the decision, with the authority to engage in that sort of removal, sort of cutting out a role for the courts here.
Yeah, that's a point of disagreement between the per curiam opinion and the concurrences. But just by the way, I just want to read this one section of the opinion further to what I said before about the particular emphasis that was placed on the fact that this is about the presidency, not just any old federal office. This is from the opinion, quote, "Finally, state enforcement of Section 3 with respect to the presidency would raise heightened concerns." And then they quote from another case from 1983, "In the context of a presidential election, state-imposed restrictions implicate a uniquely important national interest," end quote. And then it goes on to say some of the things that you and I have been discussing, "but state-by-state resolution of the question whether Section 3 bars a particular candidate for president from serving would be quite unlikely to yield a uniform answer consistent with the basic principle that the president represents all the voters in the nation," end quote.
That sounds like the sort of pragmatic argument, you know, very practical, that I expect to hear from progressives on the court and not from conservatives. So there is just that sort of weird tone to this whole opinion.
Joyce, you used the term a few times because you're fond of the Latin. You want to remind people what a per curiam opinion is?
So a per curiam opinion is an opinion that's not signed by any one judge or any one justice in this case. It's issued as an opinion of the court for all of the justices who are in that majority.
So it's essentially a majority opinion.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely what it is. It just doesn't have a signed author.
So Amy Coney Barrett, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, wrote a separate, very short, one-page concurring opinion, concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. What's the point of that?
Yeah, so here's, I think, the interesting bit that she wrote. She says, "In my judgment, this is not the time to amplify disagreement with stridency. The court has settled a politically charged issue in the volatile season of a presidential election. Particularly in this circumstance, writings on the court should turn the national temperature down, not up." And although she, you know, as you say, she concurs in the judgment, she would not go as far as the majority would go in requiring congressional action. But I think she's really writing to make this entirely different point that she makes in that sentence, that her goal here is to keep things from exploding.
Yeah, if I may, I want to read the next couple of sentences that form the conclusion of her very short two-paragraph concurring opinion. Quote, "For present purposes, our differences are far less important than our unanimity. All nine justices agree on the outcome of this case. That is the message Americans should take home," end quote. Fairly unusual to have that kind of a public-facing, direct, break-down-the-fourth-wall kind of statement to the American people, that we are unanimous in this and everyone should be supportive.
Really interesting in light of something that you and I were talking about before we started taping the podcast, right?
Yeah. I mean, now, you know, thinking back on it, when we had our discussion following the oral argument, you and I and others, you know, saw the handwriting on the wall. I think we saw it maybe a little bit earlier, even before the oral argument. But a lot of people said the real question is it going to be 9-0, 8-1, or 7-2? In retrospect, I would have put a little bit more money in Vegas on 9-0.
You know, I was at 8-1, maybe 9-0, but Justice Sotomayor was the justice that I thought might be the one.
So what you sort of have is the per curiam opinion from all nine agreeing on the outcome of this case, as Justice Barrett said. Then you have one of the women on the court, Justice Barrett, writing a concurrence, and then you have three other women also writing a concurrence. Should we talk about what their point is? And it's a conservative point.
It is a conservative point. They simply say to the majority, or rather to the per curiam about its result, you've gone too far. You've gone too far. You've said more than you needed to say. You could have just said states can't do this, and you could have been done there. But no, you had to keep going.
You know, the first sentence of the concurring opinion by Kagan Jackson and Sotomayor quotes a recent Supreme Court case. What is the recent Supreme Court case? That this very, very important monumental Supreme Court decision from the progressives in their concurrence. Which case is it? It's Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization.
You didn't really expect to see them pulling that one out, did you?
It's from Chief Justice Roberts' concurrence in the Dobbs case, which, of course, overruled Roe v. Wade. That's how they open their concurrence. And they say, quote, from Justice Roberts, if it is not necessary to decide more to dispose of a case, then it is necessary not to decide more, end quote.
They could just as easily have said, in your face.
I think that's coming. They, again, make clear that they agree with the central thrust of the per curiam opinion and emphasize, in their own words, this point that you and I have made again and again coming from the court. Quote, allowing Colorado to do so, meaning allowing Colorado to take the presidential candidate off the ballot on particular grounds, would, we agree, create a chaotic state-by-state patchwork at odds with our nation's federalism principles, end quote.
Yeah, it's clear that there is no appetite at all on this court to remove Trump from the ballot. Whatever their personal views might be, in the absence of congressional action, Trump stays.
But they disagree to some degree, because, you know, they write a 6 or 7 page opinion. In large part, that can be summarized by this sentence. The court continues on to resolve questions not before us, meaning what's the mechanism by which someone could be removed from the ballot? Is it necessary to hold and decide and conclude that Congress must take some action via legislation? They say that wasn't before the court. Why decide that? Why do you think the court did decide that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really an interesting question. I've seen a lot of people gaming out what this might mean in terms of the future, how it might impact, for instance, what happens after the election in 2024 with Congress.
Thanks for listening. To hear the full episode, head to cafe.com/insider and try out the membership for just $1 for 1 month. That's cafe.com/insider. To the many of you who have chosen to join the Insider community, thank you for supporting our work.